Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
This week, I am joined by Daniel Russell, a professor of philosophy ensconced in the Center for the Philosophy of Freedom at the University of Arizona. He specializes in ancient philosophy and ethics with the goal of expanding contemporary options for thinking about how to improve our lives. Sounds like a pretty good use of time, if you ask me. Dan has penned several books, including Plato on Pleasure and the Good Life, Practical Intelligence and the Virtues, and Happiness for Humans. He also edited the Cambridge Companion to Virtue Ethics. All of these books and more information about Dan can be found at our website, www.researchonreligion.org. So stop by and check those out, please. Dan, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony. It's great to be here.
Today's discussion is going to be a little bit different in that we're not going to be exploring the topic of religion directly, but nonetheless, we're going to be talking about things that are often important to religious people and to theologies, and that's the concepts of ideals and of virtues. And we're going to look at this from a philosophical point of view that takes us all the way back to Aristotle. And I have to come clean here and note that I really, really struggled with philosophy back in college, particularly the class that I had on Hegel. It made absolutely zero sense to me. So my first question to you is not related to our topic, but rather to you personally, reflecting on my own experience with philosophy. Whatever possessed you to become a professional philosopher as compared to, say, I don't know, a welder?
Right. Yeah, that's a question recently. Why philosophy rather than welding? I don't know. I'd like to say I followed the price signal, took advice from Hayek, went into philosophy. That's where I thought the big bucks were going to be.
Yeah.
No, maybe I followed the signal rather poorly. Honestly, it was a trade-off. I decided that I wanted to go into academics, and ultimately that grew into an interest in philosophy, but obviously not because I thought, that was the way that I'd get paid the most. I thought that it would be a way that I would get paid enough, and most of the compensation would come in the form of being able to do things every day that I really enjoy and things that I think are valuable for spending my time on. Well, I first came to philosophy actually as a theology student way, way back when in the 1980s. That was my original goal in academics. And one thing that I found as I was, I remember in particular, it really came to a head when I was taking a course in systematic theology in college. And I was going through the textbook, and there were lots of arguments, and I found some of them persuasive, and I found some of them less persuasive, but I didn't feel that I really had the tools to know what to do beyond just having those instincts. And so the next semester I signed up for a course in logic, and from there I found out that actually it was philosophy that I was more interested in. I got out of school and then I was working for a couple of years and found that in my free time philosophy was really what I wanted to read and to think about. So when I went on to graduate work, I made that my focus.
So why did you choose ancient philosophy? I mean, there's a lot of different flavors of philosophy out there, including logic. And logic I can handle, but it's sometimes you get me back to Plato and Aristotle or even contemporary stuff, Derrida and stuff. I just totally lose it. So what pushed you toward ancient philosophy?
Yeah, now, in a way, the answer is not very inspiring. The answer is I thought, well, if I'm going to begin on this discipline, I guess I should begin at the beginning, and I interpreted that at the time chronologically, and so I thought I should try to read some early thinkers and then work my way forward. I did actually start with people like Plato. I read, one of the first things I read by Plato was a dialogue called the Euthyphro. It's one that a lot of people read as their first exposure. And I found it just really fascinating. He was following a series of arguments, and I found that I could follow this, and things made sense. And I found that was a dialogue that really drew me in. Somebody else that I read early who had a big, big impact on me was the Roman Stoic philosopher Epictetus. I read him for the simple reason that I found a copy of his writings in a used bookstore and started reading that. And it was an incredibly challenging and compelling thing to read. Even now when I read Epictetus, I'm just really humbled by how challenging a thinker he was. And I don't mean that he's a difficult person to understand. Actually, his works are very, very straightforward, very easy to understand. I mean, they're challenging in the sense that they're demanding on a very personal level. He was a guy who had very, very little tolerance for nonsense and a very good sense of detecting nonsense. Often his writings take the form of saying, well, let's think about this hard problem that you have in your life. And actually, the thing I want to get across to you is that it's not a hard problem at all. It's an easy problem. It's just that the solution of it is something that you're trying to hide from, and you're hiding from it by saying that it's a hard problem. So there was something about ancient philosophy. I mean, the reasons that I started there weren't very inspiring, but the reasons that I stayed there was because I continued to find that it was extremely insightful and extremely challenging on the sorts of levels that I was looking for. And in particular, there was always a great emphasis among ancient philosophers on thinking about how to live well, thinking about the nature of virtue and character, and also thinking about the nature of well-being and how these things relate to each other. And I think that was something that I found very interesting and continue to find very interesting as well. And so I continue to stay there. Now, my work there hasn't really been, I would say, scholarly in nature. It's more been a matter of looking to ancient philosophers as sources for insights that I otherwise wouldn't have noticed, and looking for debates that develop these ideas in ways that I wouldn't have been able to do myself, and that maybe later thinkers don't focus on so much. I always keep an open mind about it. I mean, if I don't find an area of study to be returning insights that I think are making me better as someone who wants to think about the human condition, then I'll give it up and move on to something else. But that's not happened. Actually, it's just been the contrary. I think it's a very rich source of ideas.
Yeah, and what a wonderful job. You get to ask those questions that we all at our core are asking, you know, what is the good life? What is well-being? How do we flourish? And then you get paid for it, which is really cool.
Yeah, I agree. So the trade-off that I was hoping I would get to make is, in fact, just what has happened. So I'm very grateful for that. In fact, I feel very blessed in the life that I get to lead.
Now you said you give up on some of the philosophers that you get to and that don't necessarily help you ask those questions. So I got to ask this one as a little personal question. Hegel, couldn't understand Hegel. Was Hegel one of your guys?
I'm going to have to say no, Tony.
Okay.
I remember taking, after I took logic, I took Introduction to Philosophy, which was fantastic, but it was a good survey in the sense that I found out what issues and thinkers I wanted to think about some more, and I found out that there were some that probably I was better to move on and let other people work on them, and I have to say that Hegel and actually a whole tradition of philosophers is one of those. I have a hard time making sense of.
Okay, good. I don't feel so bad then. But this does take us back to who you use a lot, which is Aristotle. And you mentioned that when you were studying in graduate school, you thought the best place to start was from the beginning, and that's essentially Aristotle in the Western tradition. So What does Aristotle give us in terms of helping you understand the questions that you're interested in thinking about human flourishing, well-being, happiness, virtue?
So there are two ways to think about why Aristotle is so important, not just in my work, but really in the work of many, maybe even most people who are working in this field today, thinking about well-being and thinking about virtue. One is that, well, Aristotle is a seminal thinker in this area. In particular, the book of his that has been the most influential here is a book called The Nicomachean Ethics, which is, in fact, a book that was edited after his death. It was assembled from various essays and perhaps research notes and journals and so forth that he kept, that were gathered together as being on a set of related themes. And this is a book that was incredibly influential in the ancient world and continues to be now. So whatever a person thinks about, say, the nature of virtue or the nature of well-being, if they're studying it in a way that that isn't aware of and isn't reacting to what Aristotle did in those areas, then it really hasn't begun at the beginning, and it's not going to be able to engage in conversation. But there's a more important reason. This is the other way of looking at why Aristotle still looms so large here, is that he was seminal for a really good reason. What he gave was not just the first really systematic discussion and approach to the nature of well-being and of virtue, something like a treatise as we would recognize it, but the treatise that he gave and the treatment that he developed was one that was going to hold on then for several hundred years, even among people who took completely different views about what the virtues are and about what the good life is, as opposed to Aristotle's own approach, nonetheless embraced his general way of approaching the topics. And more than that, I think that the substance of what he said about the nature of well-being and how he approached it is one that's incredibly promising and rich. I teach a course in the philosophy of happiness at University of Arizona, and every semester I begin with Aristotle's approach to well-being. I do that because, well, for one thing, it's a very different way of thinking about well-being or happiness than students probably come in with. They probably come in thinking about happiness as the name of an emotion or a feeling or a kind of mood. You can be happy in the morning, but then not in the afternoon, that kind of thing. And Aristotle really challenges them to think about happiness in a very different way. Don't think about how it feels as you're going about your life so much as think about happiness as the name of the life that you're going about. Happiness in that sense becomes a way of thinking about a life that's well lived. And I think that's a really important perspective to have on happiness, because I think it focuses us on the practical importance that happiness and well-being have for people. The happiness as a feeling, of course, has a certain practical importance. But if happiness is how you're thinking about how you're living your life as a whole, the person that you're becoming, the relationships that you're having, now it becomes practical on a much, much deeper level. His discussion of character is also part of his discussion, as you can see, of what it is to live a good life. That has to do with who you are and the kind of person that you're becoming through the choices that you make and the relationships you form and the things that you do in them. One last thing I'll say about this, as to why Aristotle, I think, continues to be so relevant, is that he has a very mundane approach to the virtues. Now, by mundane, I don't mean that it's, uninteresting or unambitious. I mean it in the literal sense. He thinks about virtue as a familiar, ordinary part of the world. So he doesn't come at it by thinking about some special, hard-to-define category of morality that's somehow different from everything else in life. Instead, he begins in thinking about character by thinking about how people ever come to improve in their lives at all. And the most natural way to think about that is to think about how people develop practical skills. We learn as children to write, or we might learn to play musical instruments. And then we go on, and in our careers, we might learn to build, or we might learn to weld, or something like that. So something that we observe in the world all around us is people learning to do better at all kinds of things that are difficult and don't just happen without special kind of effort. And he thinks that is actually the best model for thinking about how people become better at living their lives, how people might become better friends, how they might become more generous in their treatment of other people, fairer in their treatment of other people, more courageous in living up to the things that they believe in. And I think that has kept Aristotle relevant as well, because it promises a way of thinking about virtue which actually connects it with what people say in psychology are able to study in studying the nature of skill.
Yeah, I like this approach. And when I was reading your material, I had that same mind flip that I had to go through that your students would at the beginning of your class when you asked me about happiness or virtue. I think, well, that's some kind of abstract thing that's way out there, and you just try to get to it. And when you get there, there's a big ribbon or a trophy. But this skill-based approach to it is really interesting. And that's going to be the fulcrum of what we're talking about here in a minute. And it's also part of a paper that I'm working off of today, which is called Putting Ideals in Their Place, which you've written. And you talk about ideals and virtue. So let's step back here for a moment and think about what those ideals and virtues are. And philosophers are always very careful about defining their terms. And while a lot of us might know what ideals and virtues are, there's some kind of debate about this. So go ahead and give us some of your insights on what ideals and virtues are.
Okay, well, I'll start with ideals. You're definitely right. Philosophers, sometimes it might seem rather annoying, get very, very interested in definitions and distinctions and these kinds of things. But I think a lot of what it takes to do philosophy well, frankly, is just a willingness and a kind of discipline to go slow and begin at the beginning. So when we think about ideals, there are several different senses in which we talk about ideals. And here I've really been inspired by a paper written recently by a colleague of mine at Arizona, Jen Ann Ismail. She does philosophy of science, but recently she's written a paper thinking about how ideals work in the sciences, and then extending that to other kinds of disciplines in philosophy. She distinguishes three major senses of ideals, and I think these are right. One is, when we talk about an ideal, sometimes we're talking about a perfect example. So we might mean by saying that something is an ideal or my ideal, that it's a perfect specimen, or it's what a thing would be like if it were exactly as it should be. Or sometimes we talk about ideal circumstances or ideal conditions. So under conditions which the world may never actually approximate, but which are somehow perfect and free of all the shortcomings and clutter that's familiar to us. A second related way that we talk about ideals is that ideals are objects of aspiration, that there are these things, as you said, that we sort of look to and we try to strive for, and perhaps we realize that we could never actually arrive at that ideal, but nonetheless, there's perhaps some value in striving for it endlessly. When people talk about ideals, when they talk about the virtues, often it's one or the other of these that they have in mind. They're not always very clearly distinguished, but I think that in most discussion of ideals in talking about the virtues, it's often one of these kinds. And I'm not actually that interested in either one of those. I'm more interested in a third sense of ideals, and that is an ideal understood as an abstract model that we can then use in order to focus thought. So to take an example that Jen Ann Ismail gives, which I found very useful, we might do a thought experiment in physics using an ideal pendulum. Now, an ideal pendulum is different from a real pendulum because an ideal pendulum doesn't have friction as a factor working at its fulcrum. It doesn't have wind resistance, and there aren't any exogenous forces. Nobody might come along and bump it or anything like that. So we can just then focus on what a pendulum does in the absence of all of these other factors, which for our purposes might actually just be distractions. Because what we're trying to understand, say, in constructing an ideal pendulum, is the working of gravity on a body that's swinging through an arc in that way. And so what that ideal allows us to do, this is not a matter of saying, well, if the pendulum were as it should be, this is what it would be like. Or we should try to make our real-world pendulums as like this as we can. It's rather a matter of abstracting away certain features in order to focus our attention and thought on something that's worth seeing in its own right.
Okay, and I understand that. As a social scientist, we try to do that as well, control for other factors and then just focus in on what we think to be really important and understand the mechanisms or processes there. So how does that relate to virtue? And by the way, what is your definition of virtue?
Let me start with what I take virtue to be, because if I do that, then we might be able to talk about how ideals figure in there. In a less airy-fairy kind of way.
Sounds like a good plan.
Okay, so a virtue, and I'll follow Aristotle here. A virtue is a long-standing attribute. So it's an attribute of a person. It's one of the things that makes them the sort that they are, and it's long-lasting. It's one that endures over time. We don't think that people change in how courageous they are in a very sudden fashion. It's what Aristotle called an excellence, or in Greek he called an arete. Now, that often gets translated as virtue, but the term is actually much broader than that in Greek. It refers to anything that is an excellence of a thing as the kind of thing that it is. So an arete in this broad sense is something that an animal can have. It's something that even plants can have. It's simply a way of the things being excellent in the way that's distinctive of the kind of thing that it is. Now, for people, he says that arete in the strict sense of virtue more as we understand it, is restricted just to those creatures who have the capacity of choice. In other words, to humans. And for a creature like that, its distinctive kind of excellence or arete is its excellence as a thing that has the power of choice. Part of that is that we are able to exercise practical reasoning. We don't just act on instincts and on impulses and desires, but we're able to reflect on them. We're able to reject some sorts of impulses and desires. We're able to recognize that we have reasons to do something, some things as opposed to others, and then act for those reasons. So part of being excellent in our distinctive way is being appropriately responsive to the things we have reason to do. Another part of what's distinctive of us as creatures who have choice is that our affective nature, our emotions and our desires and our feelings, are things which, at least with time and practice, we can bring into alignment with our practical reasoning. So we can start out, often we try to teach our children not just to recognize that, say, sharing with a friend is the appropriate thing to do, but also that there's a certain way that they should feel about that, that that should be part of their enjoyment of sharing time with a friend as opposed to, something that they don't want to do and an urge that they have to fight against. So that is the very general concept of virtue.
Mm-hmm. And I can see how this is starting to set up that whole concept of practice, of doing things. And that's a very different concept than a lot of us have a philosophy where you see the aspiration that's out there and you hope to get it. This is something that you develop over time through the world.
That's right. And that's, I think that's one of the reasons that that there is a lot of interest among philosophers, certainly over the past 50 years or so, in the nature of virtue. Before that, there was a sense that perhaps ethical issues in philosophy had come a bit adrift of how people actually live their lives, how they raise their children, what they want for themselves, and how they want to develop within their relationships. So here, virtue isn't seen as one part of life among many. Perhaps that one part that puts up all of these regrettable but you have to live within these kinds of constraints on your other sorts of pursuits. Instead, it sees it as getting better at doing the kinds of things that are important to a person as a person goes about their life. So it's not so much a matter of putting your interest on some special distinct group of categories and goals which a person ought to pursue. It's not really focused so much on good deeds. It's focused really on how you do everything else in your life that you do. It's not so much some special category of action. It's more like how you engage in other sorts of actions. Do you engage with them in a way that's intelligent, in a way that's wise? Do you engage in them in a way with emotions that are appropriate? So there's a very different kind of focus.
Now, in terms of virtues, we oftentimes in common speak talk about there's a set of virtues. The Boy Scouts have a list of 12 laws that they consider to be virtues, and we go through those: trustworthy, loyal, helpful, all those kind of things. Do philosophers have a list of these virtues? Did Aristotle have a set of these are the things that when we reason and think about our lives that we strive toward?
Yes, this is a difficult issue, actually. I think it's one that I've written on a bit some years ago, and I think that it's something that philosophers haven't thought through quite enough. Even in the ancient world, there were very, very different approaches to this. One approach was to say that there is a closed list. So I could actually read off what the attributes are that are the virtues. And these lists were actually very short, sometimes five. Plato started with a list of five and got it down by the end of his career to a list of four. Among the ancient Stoics, there was a list of four. And we find this, for instance, in people like Aquinas as well, and in the notion of the cardinal virtues. Now, the benefit of that kind of approach is that you have this nice, tidy, and fairly short, elegant list of what the virtues are. The downside to that approach is, well, you have this very, very tidy, short list of what the virtues are, and it's hard to be confident that somehow, in this short list, you figured out all of the ways that there are for humans to be excellent as they go about their lives. So what it gets in simplicity, we might think it's kind of lacking in complexity and thoroughness. Well, the other way to go then is with Aristotle's own kind of approach. He had a list of virtues, but I don't see that he ever thought that he was giving a closed list of virtues. And his list isn't particularly systematic in that kind of way. I wouldn't actually be able to say for Aristotle exactly how many virtues there are. I can say how many he talked about, but did he talk about all the virtues that he thought that there are? That's not clear. Now, the benefit of that sort of approach is that it really does bring in all of the complexity and richness that we think good character might have. Aristotle doesn't just talk about fairly obvious virtues like fairness or generosity. He also talks about virtues like wit, being good in conversation. He talks about virtues where you know how to bear yourself in social settings and perhaps in public settings and these other kinds of things. So we get a very rich discussion of all the different virtues that there are. The downside to that approach, though, is that there's no sense of closure to it. Now, why is that a problem? Well, if you think that there's some value in talking about people being completely virtuous, not just virtuous in this way, but lacking in these other kinds of ways. If you, for instance, want to talk about how each virtue is connected with all of the other virtues, which Aristotle, by the way, also wants to do, then there's immediately this question. Well, what do you mean, the other virtues? Surely there can't be infinitely many. But what exactly are these other virtues? If there are ones that we haven't identified, that aren't on the list yet, there's going to be something in our discussion of the other virtues that's going to be missing, at least insofar as we think that the virtues should form a sort of integrated package or a sort of integrated whole. So all of that to say, I think that's a really great question, and it's one that I don't think that there's an easy answer to. I think it's something we need to think about more.
Does it also leave open the door to relativism? I mean, you talk about we're excellent in different things. There's generosity. I think most people would say, yes, that's a virtue. Being generous is good. Wit, on the other hand, I don't know. Maybe some people don't. And could you even extend that to say, well, stealing stuff, because there's a population of thieves, and the person who can steal stuff really well has a great virtue for thievery. And for most of us, that would just seem, nah, I don't think that should fit in the category of virtues.
Yeah, that's right. Now, there is a kind of excellence that Aristotle talks about, which in our translations he calls cleverness. And he thinks that you can have that virtue, you can have that capacity, let's call it, regardless of what your character is, because cleverness is just being good at matching means to ends. So whatever your ends are, it's possible to be savvy about good ways to execute them in the world, and you can have that regardless of your character. However, that isn't how he thinks about virtue of character overall. It's not simply a matter of doing whatever you're doing, but doing it in a more effective way. It's Aristotle, as I often put it, thinks of virtuous activity as, again, not some special category of activity, but any activity a person engages in, provided that that person engages in it with practical intelligence and with emotional soundness. Now, by practical intelligence and emotional soundness, those are really the two aspects of what he means by virtue or by excellence. But here's why that doesn't just reduce down to a kind of relativism. That excellence has to be understood as not just whatever happens to facilitate, the goals of a particular individual. Because individuals belong to a category. They belong to the category of humankind. And an excellence, in Aristotle's sense, is an excellence that a thing has as the kind of thing that it is. So in order for a person to have an excellence, in order for a person to have a virtue, in this sense, they need to be excellent in ways that are distinctive of our kind. So the work then gets pushed to saying, well, okay, but what does it mean to be excellent in a way that's distinctive of a human being? And here, Aristotle goes through and he thinks about all of the different aspects of human life that are important to living a life well. For instance, one of the things that's characteristic of human life is that it's social. We don't just live near other people and, manage to cooperate with other people, but there's something valuable about spending our time and spending our lives in company with other people and having relationships of all different sorts. So one of the things that it's going to take in order for a person to live well and to be excellent in a way that's distinctive of human is they're going to need certain excellences that allow those relationships to be flourishing for them. So that's why he thinks, for example, generosity is an important virtue, because it's one of the ways that it's important to be able to do well as one lives one's life and engages in relationships that they want to be close in a distinctively human way. So if if anything, the charge that often gets leveled against Aristotle is that this is too objective a way of thinking about virtue, too objective a way of thinking about well-being. In a modern setting, people often think about the good life as, well, whatever life happens to be good for an individual, given what that individual is like and what concerns and interests that individual happens to have. Aristotle is, of course, aware that individuals are very, very different. So he doesn't try to think about the virtuous life or the happy life as a particular walk of life. Instead, this is why he thinks of it as, well, no, you figure out what your goals are and pursue those. Virtue isn't so much about that. Virtue is about the kind of person you are and how you go about integrating the different kinds of goals you have and the way that you act in pursuing them.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned something a little bit earlier about character, and that was an intriguing part of your paper and of the work that you do. And you contrast it with some of the work being done on character or personality in psychology. Explain where that is all coming from and how Aristotle might have approached that.
Right. So this has become a big issue in people who study character in philosophy over the past, say, 15 to 20 years. Now, to say why, we have to go back actually to the early 20th century in psychology. Whatever personality is, it has to have two features. One of those is what psychologists call stability. Stability refers to the fact that a person's character is long-lasting. It doesn't just change from day to day. So, more specifically, stability is such that a person's personality or their personality traits will generate similar kinds of behaviors in similar kinds of situations over time. So, for instance, if you give me a multiple choice test today and I take advantage of an opportunity to cheat and look on the answer sheet or something like that, then it's not unlikely that if you were to give me a similar test next week, that I would do something dishonest on that as well. So that's the stability side. The other side of it is what psychologists call consistency. And consistency is the idea that personality isn't just about how I take tests. Right, that the trait that's accounting for that isn't some sort of one-off thing. It's something much broader than that, has much broader implications. So if I'm the sort of person who will cheat on multiple choice tests, then I might also be the sort of person who will cheat on essay tests. And I might also be the sort of person who's more likely to take money or to tell lies or to break promises or to do other sorts of things that are dishonest. So consistency, to say that a person's personality is consistent is to say that it will generate similar sorts of behaviors even in different sorts of situations, but provided that those different situations still elicit that same kind of response. Okay. Now, the problem in the 20th century was that when people then began observing subjects' behaviors and then trying to extrapolate what their personality traits were and then looking to confirm those extrapolations with predictions of future behavior, they found two things. One, they found that stability worked pretty well. So it turns out that if a person will cheat on a test this week, it really is not unlikely that person will cheat on a test next week. The problem, though, was consistency. So the second thing that they found was that predictions of consistency weren't very good. So if a person was, it was the sort who will cheat on tests, it didn't necessarily predict for that person, telling lies or breaking promises or taking money or something like that. And so that was the real problem, was understanding consistency. Now, in the 1960s and 70s, this really this really did come to a head. People started now studying consistency as its own kind of phenomenon, and the evidence for it wasn't very good, and this meant that there was something of a crisis in trying to understand what personality is in psychology. In the 1990s and certainly in the 2000s, a bunch of philosophers were then picking up on this debate from psychology and saying, well, look, if there's not much evidence for consistency of personality, then it looks like our traditional views of what personality is and how people work with respect to personality aren't actually very sound. Now, what difference does that make for studying the virtues? Well, when we study the virtues, what we're doing is we're saying that people have certain kinds of stable and consistent traits that account for the choices they make and the behaviors that they engage in. But if what we're learning from psychology is that that's not actually how human behavior works, then it looks like trying to think about moral development, for instance, and moral behavior in terms of how people act on certain virtues is sort of beside the point and irrelevant. As if we're trying to explain ethical behavior using a psychological model which isn't actually describing anything that's real. So that was the that was where things were about 5 or 10 years ago, and so that's why there is even now a lot of interest in trying to hook up what we say about the nature of virtue with what our best understanding of human personality might be. Now, that's not the end of the story either in psychology or in philosophy, but that's already a long answer, so I'll
well, it certainly sets up a big challenge for philosophers, and I'm sure this is giving you a lot of things to wrestle with, which is good because it keeps you employed, keeps you in business. So let's try to figure out how you wrestle with this, because you do this in your paper and in your other work, and I think it's really interesting. Tell us about virtue and how it becomes developed and to what extent it matches with these psychological approaches. Let's put psychology aside for a moment and just talk about the development of virtue. And you talk about different ways of getting there, path-independent and path-dependent means. What does that all mean?
Okay. Well, actually, let me start by putting, you just put psychology to the side. I want to put it back in the middle here for just a moment. Because
fair enough.
The way in which this issue got resolved in psychology is actually very relevant to thinking about how it gets resolved in philosophy and how we find a way forward. So the problem for understanding consistency, as I said, was if a trait is consistent, that means that it should generate similar behaviors even in different sorts of situations. So I gave the example of if someone cheats on tests, then that person might be expected to be more likely to steal money. So the idea is the behaviors are similar in the sense that they're both acts of dishonesty, but the situations are different. One is a test situation, one is a money situation. But here's the problem, and this is the kind of question that philosophers really love. What do you mean by similar and different? Now, that sounds like a really pedantic question, but it isn't if you think about it. So suppose that we see two people go through an empty room. Suppose that one person goes through an empty room and there's a dollar lying on a table. The first person goes through, sees the dollar, walks past, leaves it there. Now we watch a second person, goes through the same room, sees the same dollar, sees the dollar, stops, puts it in his pocket, moves on. Have these two people behaved in different fashion? Were the situations the same? Now, in one sense, it might seem tempting to say, well, yeah, it was the same room, it was the same dollar, pocketing it is the opposite of taking it. But the problem with that is that we're now trying to make inferences about these people's personalities by not looking at how they read the situation, but by sticking in our own way of reading the situation. Mm-hmm. But that's extraordinary. Why would you think that how somebody else behaves should have something to do with how some third party is reading the situation? So the other way to think about it is, no, what we really need to know is how the first person saw the situation and how the second person saw the situation. It could be that the first person walked through and thought, well, that dollar isn't mine, so if I took it, that would be like stealing. The second person might have walked through and seen the dollar and say, wow, that's like finding a dollar in the street. It doesn't belong to anybody. It's just here for the taking. Great, I'll have it. Those are very, very different ways of looking at that situation. And that, so when we're talking about what a person did and how to describe it in terms of that person's personality, it seems important not just to assume what the situations are. Actually, one of the most important clues about a person's personality is how they read and interpret and construe these different kinds of situations. Once psychologists started looking at that as a big part of personality, they found that consistency came back in the game. So what happened was consistency went from just being, well, what looks consistent to some third-party neutral observer, to consistency with how people read situations, interpret them, attach meaning to them, and then how they adjust their behavior to those situations. And that's important for thinking about character, because that gives us a way to think about a person's character as well. We don't have to think about the consistency of something like honesty from some third person's point of view. We can think instead about honesty as a certain way of viewing the world, of what things a person cares about, how a person interprets and reads situations in terms of what they care about, how critical they are in accepting information that suggests this is or is not an opportunity for generosity. And then also in how intelligently they're able to adjust their behaviors to do something which really is, say, generous or honest in the circumstance as they find it. So that's a way of trying to bring personality back onto the table by rethinking what exactly we mean by saying that a person's personality or their behavior is consistent. Now, that's also relevant for thinking about how people develop, because what emerged from this coming to terms with the notion of consistency was a different way of thinking about personality. Instead of just thinking of it as a simple input-output mechanism where you have situations going in on one side and they elicit certain kinds of responses and then behaviors come out on the other side. Instead, personality is actually all of those mechanisms and gears and working inside of those boxes. And those mechanisms fall into two basic categories. One are psychological mechanisms for interpreting and construing our experience, and second are mechanisms for then adjusting our behaviors to pursue certain kinds of goals, given how we have construed those situations. When we think about the development of character, then, we can think about character as a way of taking this basic or raw human capacity for consistency, and could we develop that and train and educate that so that it's not just consistency with whatever standard I happen to have, but it's consistency with respect to some excellent standard, some good standard. And that's interesting, because as soon as you put the question that way, the natural thing to think of is skill. Isn't that precisely what people do when they learn to play the piano or they learn to write a sentence? They take the raw human capacity for developing consistency relative to some standard or other, and they turn it into consistency with regard to the excellent standard, a good standard for the field in which they're working. And so that gives us some hope that what we learn about how people improve as they develop skills could also shed some light and give us some insight into how people improve as they develop excellences of character, for instance, trying to become generous or trying to become fair, trying to be a good friend.
And that is where all this stuff on virtues come in, which is kind of neat. So explain, too, what you mean by this. You mentioned that Aristotle takes a path-dependent approach to this skill development. What does that all mean?
Oh, yes. So I've talked about this this possible picture that might be able to merge insights from psychology and insights from philosophy. Now, there's a really important division of labor between philosophers and psychologists. Philosophers do what we might call, sorry, I'll start with psychologists. Psychologists engage in sort of a descriptive enterprise. What they're trying to do is to understand the mechanisms that are there that account for how people behave and how they learn and how they develop. So they're trying to map out all of these different paths, as I call them, by which people develop. So when we think, here's a way of thinking about it. One of the things that we find when we look at humans is that they have some combination of psychological features which open up certain paths for them. They open up paths by which, for instance, they can learn to speak languages or they can learn to play musical instruments. My dog has lots of psychological capacities, but those psychological capacities don't end up to this pathway for my dog, such that with a certain kind of training of these raw mechanisms, my dog can speak a language or my dog can play a musical instrument. But my children, for example, we send them to piano lessons. And so what we're doing is we are helping them to exploit these mechanisms that their basic human psychology provides for them, so that they can then pursue an excellence along this path that that those mechanisms make available. So what psychologists do is try to figure out what those paths are and how people manage to get better at doing things using these basic capacities. Philosophers, on the other hand, are engaged in a normative enterprise. They are trying to understand what counts as improvement. What psychologists can do is they can tell us the number of ways in which people are able to change and develop. What philosophers want to understand is, well, given the ways in which people are able to change and develop, in which direction is it better for people to go in changing and development? What counts as an improvement? Or as I sometimes put it, in what direction does better lie? Psychologists can tell us about how people get better, but we need to understand what we mean by better. What kinds of changes would count as better in a person's character and in a person's behavior? Okay, now that's the division of labor. A second question is, as I put it, is the sequencing of that labor. So one very common approach is to say, well, obviously what you do is you set your goals first and then you figure out your means. So philosophers are talking about goals. And so what philosophers need to do is they need to figure out what would count as moral maturity, what would count as having a good character. And so they construct ideals. And then we then look to psychology to say, okay, how do we implement that? Or how do we get there from here? Now, there is something that seems very natural about that approach. What could seem more natural than identifying a goal and then choosing your means? The problem with that approach is that by putting the psychological work second, we really don't have any constraints on the feasibility of what our picture of moral development should be on the philosophical side. And that's really important because we go through all of this work of constructing this ideal, and then we look to psychology and say, okay, how do we get there from here? And they might simply look at us and say, sorry, we can't get there from here. That's not how people work. We don't have the kinds of pathways by which people can change in that kind of way. So, for example, one psychologist I've learned quite a bit from, named Robin Hogarth, he looks in particular at how people go about the hiring process. And among the many things that he looks at in that process are things like, you know, bias and prejudice and how they creep into the hiring process. I found it rather discouraging. He said that, you know, things like prejudices against sex or against race, probably we don't get rid of those altogether. But what we can do is we can learn to arrest them as they arise. We can learn to recognize them and to neutralize them so that they don't actually end up affecting our judgment. Now, that's to say, well, we can never actually get to the ideal of perfect virtue in which a person would be completely free of all of these different kinds of biases. And that looks like a strike against trying to think about virtue as a way of getting better. But there's another way of sequencing the work, and that is to say, look, why don't we start the other way with psychology and try to understand how people do work, what limitations they have, what kinds of capacities they have for overcoming those, what the limitations on them are, and then, given an understanding of how people are actually able to change, we can then try to map out what would count as doing better given those paths that are actually available. So, in short, the idea is, instead of looking at some ideal and everything we learn about psychology discouraging us from thinking that we found the right way to think about character, we simply start with what the limitations are and with what the different kinds of opportunities are in terms of our psychological makeup. And from among the psychologically feasible options for people, we can then try to identify the ones that would constitute genuine improvement in character.
And I can see how this fits well with Aristotle's view of the ideals and what we were talking about earlier about ideals, not as something that's floating out there that we always try to get to, but something that's more developmental, I would guess, you know, skill-based. And, you know, taking the piano example, we only have 10 fingers, we don't have 20 fingers, so that's the path that we're on, and that's how we define excellence. Am I reading that correctly?
I think you are. Actually, I like that example a lot. So if you had an ideal theory of piano playing, which, you know, describe the skill, what are 88 keys on a piano? Well, imagine a theory of ideal piano playing that required a pianist with 88 fingers. Well, there might be something interesting about that ideal, but there's not going to be anything interesting about it for people who are actually trying to learn the piano. And that I think is really Aristotle's sort of approach. He says early on in the Nicomachean Ethics that the point of the study is not just to understand some concept as if it had fallen from the sky. The point of the study is to try to figure out how people actually get better.
Yeah.
And so how do we know we are getting better? You address that question, and your answers are fascinating here.
Yes. Perhaps one of the most important aspects of virtue, and the one that opens up a lot of really interesting tests for whether a person is getting better, is practical intelligence, or what Aristotle calls phronesis. Now, phronesis, or practical intelligence, is a kind of skill. It's a deliberative skill, or it's a skill of making decisions. Now, it plays a very particular role in the decision-making process. A moment ago, I talked about goals, and I talked about ends. So Aristotle says that virtue makes the goals right. So take generosity. To say that I'm a generous person is to say that I have a sort of standing goal of helping other people, and that that's part of my psychological makeup, that's part of how I look at the world and I seek out different kinds of opportunities. Okay. Now, it's not enough just to have the goal. I also mentioned a moment ago this capacity that Aristotle calls cleverness. So I have to be able to work out the means as well. So if I have a friend who comes to me and he asks, you know, can he borrow $100 until next month? Well, if I'm a generous person, that's to say that I have this goal of wanting to be helpful to my friend. Now, you can see why that's not going to be enough, because suppose that I decide to make the loan. Well, what's the best way to get it to my friend? It, would it be better to to give cash in this situation? Would it be better to write a check? Should I, you know, send him a payment through PayPal? So there are all of these very ordinary kinds of issues of execution that I have to understand as well. Now, what's tempting is to think, well, okay, and those are the two parts. Those are the two parts of the problem: get the goal right, then get the means right. Where Aristotle, I think, had a very profound insight was that there has to be a second, there has to be a middle step in between those goals. Because think about what the goal was that I have in virtue of being generous. It's to be helpful to my friend. Now, that's a good goal, but you'll notice that it's also an indeterminate goal. What I need to be able to do in order to figure out what course of action to take with my friend is to think, but what would count as helping my friend given this situation, given my situation, and given all of the circumstances that there are around us? Because it might be that the best thing I could do for my friend would be to make the loan. It might be that the worst thing I could do for my friend is to make the loan. It could be that, for example, is this every month or every other month this person is in financial trouble because he's irresponsible or he's careless, and I've just sort of become his way of dealing with this irresponsibility and carelessness. It's not clear in that kind of circumstance that the helpful thing to do is to lend the money. The helpful thing to do might be to draw a line in the sand and say, we have to figure out a different way of addressing the underlying issue. So practical intelligence is important for decision-making in this middle step of going from an indeterminate goal to a determinate goal, an actual course of action. Okay, now to get to your question about how do we know whether we're improving, there are two main roles that I see practical intelligence is playing there. One is the one I just talked about, and that is practical intelligence is a matter of specifying or making determinate the goal of a virtue, such as generosity. And here we do have a way of getting some feedback on whether or not we actually are being helpful to other people in ways that matter. The second role is that because generosity is an excellence, it's more than just a blind disposition to engage in some sort of stereotypical, open-handed kind of behavior. A really not very sophisticated way of generosity would say, well, if you're generous and a friend asks for $100, you just give the $100. But you can see that you need a more sophisticated understanding than that, because what if, in giving this $100, I'm actually being unfair to myself? I'm allowing myself to be used or exploited or manipulated. Or if what if the only reason I'm inclined to give this $100 is I don't have the courage to say no when I know that that's exactly what I should do? Or what if the $100 I'm debating about is $100 that I've already promised to my landlord? For example, when I signed a lease agreement, agreeing to pay a certain amount in rent every month, what if that money has also been spoken for? So in order for generosity to function as an excellence, it doesn't just have to be targeted towards its own goal considered in isolation. It also has to be integrated with other sorts of goals that are relevant to other virtues. In this example, I've talked about justice or fairness as well as courage as other virtues that are relevant. So another way in which we can assess whether someone is getting better, getting more virtuous, is whether their behavior with respect to one virtue is becoming more intelligent and more sophisticated because it's becoming more integrated with good choices and good character in other areas of life as well.
That I find to be really interesting, especially now as I reflect upon social media, where somebody is accused of not being generous for not wanting to give $100, and their reputation can be quite damaged, and people make fun of them, etc., etc. But that, for me, it seems that a lot of these, attempts to make people look non-generous, if we want to use that virtue, is really ignoring this integrated concept of what all the virtues need to be doing together.
I think that's right. In fact, in an earlier publication, I actually defended what might sound like a perverse thesis, and that is, if you look at two people, and one of them gives a lot less and on a lot fewer occasions than the other, that person might actually be the more generous of the two. In fact, take a single individual who goes from giving on more occasions to giving on fewer occasions, that individual might be becoming more generous rather than less. Now, that sounds perverse if you think about generosity as just this disposition to do stereotypically and open-handed things. And people sometimes define it that way, as if to be generous is just to be disposed to give lots of stuff on lots of occasions. But if you think about generosity as an excellence, you can see how, I mean, that can be a completely reckless thing to do. We don't want to, you know, look at a parent who refuses to say no to a teenage child who wants them to, you know, to buy liquor and supply it for a party with all of their teenage friends. As somehow the parent would be generous by being giving in that way on this sort of occasion. And you can think about people who are very, very open-handed, but they come to realize that they're not being very smart, they're not being very wise in their open-handedness. One, they might not actually be doing very much good for the people that they're giving to. They might actually be hurting people that they're giving to. Or second, they might be hurting themselves, or they might be hurting third parties. So actually becoming more intelligent in giving is perfectly consistent with actually giving less or giving on fewer occasions. So I think it's important to have a much more sophisticated understanding of virtue as an excellence with a role to play in human life and not just as some sort of disposition. And that's Aristotle's perspective, and that's one of the many reasons I think that it's a very insightful and powerful perspective.
And you do a wonderful job of laying that out in all your works, your papers, and your books, so we're going to point people back to those so that they can get fuller insights on that. I do want to finish off with one question, though, because our podcast is entitled Research on Religion, and we really haven't talked about religion yet. And this isn't something that's not necessarily in your papers, but I want to go ahead and let you reflect upon this a little bit. To what role does religious belief and or religious institutions such as churches or synagogues or mosques play in the development of virtue? Is that an external force that helps to discipline our practical reasoning a bit, or what other role might it be playing?
I think that's a great question. It's something that I think I would benefit from thinking about a lot more. I am a religious person myself, but the ancient perspective and Aristotle's perspective on the virtue is a very secular perspective, and so a lot of my work has taken that kind of shape as well. But there are two things that occur to me that I would like to say about that. One is at the level of individuals and persons, what does religion, how might religion contribute to the development of character and virtue for individuals? And one thing I would say is that religion is a source of a safeguard against complacency. There's an emphasis in my approach to the virtues that is very cautious. So when I talk about my approach to virtue being path dependent, what I mean by that is we start with understanding what's actually feasible, what's actually possible, and then we try to understand within the set of feasible options which of these are the most desirable and which would count as improvements. I think that is a valuable way of thinking about improvement. It's a way of thinking about it that can benefit a lot from the economic way of thinking. However, the danger in that emphasis on feasibility is that a person might become complacent about what's possible. Do we mean possible given the current personality shortcomings that I have? What's feasible, is that independent from what we find inspiring? Or is what we find inspiring somehow part of what makes something feasible, because we need to be inspired in order to be challenged and to be engaged in a process and to improve. So one of the things that I think religion can do for the betterment of character is that it does give people this this other side of the equation, and that is that constant drive to aspire and to improve. We have models of people for us in religious texts. We go to services at synagogue or at mosque or at church in which those models are discussed for us. Sometimes they're negative models, but we get this constant sense of as Saint Paul put it, of a race to be run, and of striving to be better than one is, and perhaps better than one can imagine being. And there are, of course, certain virtues that we talk about only in theological contexts, which are virtues of trusting in a force greater than yourself that you will have the strength to be more than you're able to be just on your own merit. The other thing I'll say, you asked also about institutions. Well, what about churches and other sorts of religious organizations? I think that they do, and they certainly should take themselves to have the power to change the world. It's not clear that the best way to change the world is to try to take in the world in one go. One very powerful way to change the world is to change it one person at a time. In part, that's what I was just talking about. But something that seems important to me, and I've been in churches my whole life, and something I haven't always seen enough of, is how we deal with things like conflict within these organizations. Anybody who has the expectation that as soon as you enter a community of people who are unified by a shared faith, that somehow you're going to find a different breed of animal in here, right? That somehow people are selfless, that people always cooperate, that people always know what it takes to cooperate, and so forth. A moment's thought says, that's not really realistic. So conflicts do arise. I mean, even in very, very small ways, people who are agreed in trying to do the right thing have very, very different visions about how to do it, or even just how to implement it. Things as simple as musicians are rehearsing together to play for a service. Should there be, what chord should we play in the measure that's between the first and the chorus, or should there be two measures, and what should the chords be? And disputes and conflicts will actually, as you would expect, erupt over these very, very simple kinds of things. I think one thing that churches and other organizations could do well is to try, one, to do more in preventing the circumstances in which those things arise. So it needs to be clear, make it clearer, for example, what the who gets to make what decisions. And then also, as the conflicts arise, how it is right within the perspective of one's religion to deal with those kinds of things. So I guess what I'm saying is often there's a lot of what goes on behind the scenes in the running of a church and in the working of a church and in the day-to-day of it and in other organizations as well. And I think there it's important to think about what we're learning as a kind of skill in how we relate to each other so that we become more transparent. And by that I mean we get ourselves out of the picture and we allow ourselves to be more vessels for the sort of action and edification that the church is about.
Yeah, that is really neat, is that religious communities are places that where you can practice developing virtue. It's not just a launching pad for taking virtue to the world, but you have to start there first. Wonderful insights about virtue, about ideals, about Aristotle, and about religion. And I want to thank Dan Russell for being my guest today on Research on Religion. Dan, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tony. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.